But next, we're going to be talking about hate with Matthew Williams. He's a professor of criminology who directs the Hate Lab at Cardiff University, which assesses the impact of national events on hate crime. His book, The Science of Hate, was published on Thursday. It's based on 20 years of research, including for UK and US government departments, and is on his own experience as a hate crime victim. In the book, he examines the tipping point between prejudice and hate and talks to both hate crime victims and the perpetrators about the causes of hateful behaviour. Matthew Williams joins me now. Hello.
Hello, Hugo.
Thanks very much for being with us. Look, let's dive right in. Why do we hate?
We learn to hate. So there are certain elements of our I guess neurowiring, our neurochemistry that predispose us or give us the capacity to have these kinds of attitudes and feelings that approximate hate. But ultimately it's learning to hate that the book really delves into, and it's split into two parts essentially. So the first part really goes through the kind of neuroscience of hate. For example, I get my brain scanned to identify whether or not that I react differently to black or white faces, for example. So it goes through all those kinds of hard science type approaches to hate, and it reveals ultimately that while we have the capacity to hate, it isn't something that's innate, really. It's something that we actually learn through life. And that's the second part of the book, essentially, where it starts to look at things like what I call them accelerants. So what are the kinds of life experiences that can happen to individuals that can accelerate them beyond prejudice to hate? And I think you mentioned in the introduction there that, you know, what the Hate Lab does is look at things like events. And in fact, one of the chapters in the book deals with events, and we call them kind of trigger events, if you like. They trigger individuals to commit hate crimes either on the streets or indeed online.
Yeah, and you start the book with a sort of quite a moving account of your own experience as a victim of a hate crime on Tottenham Court Road, which you say basically changed your life direction, but pushed you into criminology in the first place. And I mean, in a way, this book is like the product of that journey. Tell us a little bit about why that experience caused you to wish to write this book, or at least and do this kind of lifetime of research.
Yes, it was back in the late 1990s that I finished my degree and went to London to celebrate with friends, as you do. And I was in a bar, stepped out into the heavy London air to have a cigarette. I don't smoke anymore, like, glad to say, but at the time I did. And as I was about to flick the flint on my Zippo lighter, a man approached me and asked me for a light. I obliged. And then everything went black, and I woke up on the floor, and it appeared that I had been attacked. And it seemed like three men had planned this attack, not necessarily against me, but anyone coming out of the bar that I was in. And it was actually a gay bar. So it wasn't a crime of opportunity as such. It was something very, very planned. It became very apparent that it was a hate crime as they sort of walked off with their prize, if you like, the attack itself, and used a homophobic slur. So it became very apparent what had happened to me in that moment. And it was really destabilizing. It's the first time something like that ever happened to me. It changed my life, as you said. I was, like yourself, I wanted to be a journalist. I was about to do an MA in journalism. And the attack just really sort of took hold of me in a way that I'd never imagined something like that could. Constant questions about why me, and it, with a hate crime, you kind of do know why me, in a sense. It's kind of, it's you because of what you represent to them. But I was confused as to what motivated my attackers to do that to me that day, and I was looking for something concrete between me and them that could explain away quite conveniently the difference between me and them. But actually, my 20-year scientific journey to find out why revealed that I probably have more in common with them than that separates us. You know, there was nothing really about them that separated them from me in any concrete way. It was more likely their experiences through life, the kinds of scapegoats they had while growing up, the exposure to various events and peers, etc. And I kind of came to the conclusion in the book that, you know, had my life taken a slightly different direction, I could have been committing the hate crimes instead of researching them. And that's where the kind of science led me. It wasn't something that we think of hate criminals as these monsters, these individuals that we can't understand. But ultimately, when you dig into the science and you begin to realize how we're all very prejudiced, but we suppress these prejudices most of the time. But ultimately, we aren't aware of many of them that we have. And if we're not careful, these prejudices can grow unbeknownst to us because of the various accelerants that I talk about, and possibly could turn into hate.
What's the kind of, how would you define a hate crime as opposed to sort of, you know, well, sort of hateful behavior generally? What's the kind of tipping point there?
So it depends what you're looking at. So in the book, I look at the UK, but I also look at the US. So it's an interesting dilemma. Can you imagine that the hate crime rate in England and Wales is 10 times that of America? 10 times that of America. It doesn't seem possible, but it all comes down to how you count it. In the UK, we're very good at it. We on paper, we look like an incredibly hateful nation. You look at the hate crime rates, either collected by, you know, recorded by the police, or in fact recorded by surveys such as the Crime Survey for England and Wales, and we were off the charts compared to most other countries. But it's because of the way in which we record it. Ultimately, it's a victim-centered definition in the UK. So the police will record a hate crime if a person feels that their identity has been targeted. And the police can't then come in and say, well, I don't think there's enough evidence for this. They just have to accept that the victim's perspective or the witness's perspective is gospel. So this is why we seem to have this kind of hate crime problem, because people are actually reporting their own personal experience regardless of evidence. And I'm not saying that the evidence isn't there, because very often it's very hard to prove a hate crime. It's very hard. You can't delve into the offender's mind and then piece together some motivation. You know, sometimes this is called policing thought crime, as we've seen expressed in the press often. You know, it's very difficult to identify motivation, which is why in the law in England and Wales, we can also look at demonstration of hostility. So if a person, for example, uses a slur during the attack, and that's witnessed or caught on say, video phone or CCTV, or if they have, you know, markings on their clothes, or they're known to associate with groups that are known to have prejudices, then the evidence builds up against that individual, and then we might be able to prosecute. But it's the important point to make, I think, about the definition, is that, you know, while we had around 106,000 hate crimes in the last financial year as recorded by the police, only around about 10% of those get to the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service. And of those, around about 78% get successfully prosecuted. So we're talking, you know, 8,000 of those, 106,000 actually get to the courts and are successful. So it kind of shows you this interesting dilemma between what we define it as at one end and what can be prosecuted at the other. And I think that's an inherently interesting phenomenon, and I think quite unique to hate, actually.
And why is it useful for us to separate hate crimes, or at least to understand hate crimes as a specific category of violent crime, rather than necessarily just lumping them together in every way?
Well, if we go back to the time I was attacked, so that was around 1997, and at the time, there was no legislation whatsoever against homophobic hate crime. There wasn't actually any legislation against racial hate crime at the time. That came in 1998, and sort of legislation that dealt with homosexuality and crimes motivated by a hatred towards homosexuality came in 2003. So when I was attacked, I knew I was a victim of hate, but I couldn't actually report it. And I actually felt quite devalued as a citizen. I felt unprotected by my state. I felt as if I cared just that little bit less than the average citizen. And when the legislation came in, I felt entirely different. I actually felt, for the first time, protected by something. Like the state was saying, we won't tolerate this kind of behavior in this country. You know, this is not what the UK is. And it felt like a sort of a clarion call almost, indicating that we need to do something about this, and the highest power in the land is actually kind of enacting this law. And so I think when we talk about legislation and separating hate crimes from average violent crimes, I think it's as much about trying to prosecute, because the offences are much more serious in terms of the impact on the victim, so much more destabilising than a random act of violence on a Saturday night, for example. And ultimately, you know, also the impacts last for much longer, actually, because usually these individuals are repeat victims. Mm. They get repeatedly attacked as opposed to possibly that random act of violence on a Saturday night. But I think the really important thing is the communication element of law. Law communicates a set of standards that ultimately we should all aspire to. And I think this is kind of coming out now with the debate about gender-based hate and the wish to introduce gender-based hate crimes. Scotland missed the opportunity with their hate crime bill a few weeks ago, but currently, as we know, in Westminster, it has been mm-hmm. debated, and now forces are going to collect data and allow the recording of gender-based hate crimes. And I think that's an important move, because if you look at the actual statistics on this, of all the various categories of hate, if you were to include gender-based hate, it would be the third most prevalent hate crime that we have out there. And how do I know that? Well, if you look at the crime survey for England and Wales, it actually asks the question of the respondents in that survey, have you been a victim of a crime where your identity was targeted? So it's not saying a victim of a hate crime, but a crime mm-hmm. where your identity was targeted. And around of the 333,000 hate crimes that were recorded in that period by the survey back in 2018, 26% of those were women saying that they were targeted because of their identity. That's about, we're talking around about sort of 70-75% there.
It's a huge
which is significant.
Huge number. Well, look, more with Matthew Williams in a moment on this fascinating subject. Stick with us. To let you know, in about 50 minutes, I'll be chatting to Carol Midgley about the week's TV. We've got Line of Duty, Football's Darkest Secret, The Mole Agent, and This Is My House. Do get in touch with any views on any of those. This is Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio in association with NetWealth. Find out more at netwealth.com.
Times Radio Breakfast.
The biggest stories and the biggest guests from politics, business and the arts.
Have you earned your breakfast yet?
Not yet.
I need another 20 push-ups from you.
20 push-ups
and a few squats.
I'm ready to go.
Making sense of a changing world.
10 years since you first proposed this. If it's another 10 years, what will it mean to people who face worries about social care?
It really is a stain on our nation. If we were to carry on like this, I think we would deserve to feel ashamed of ourselves.
The perfect percolation of news, lifestyle, business and culture.
We've allowed our children to name the cat.
You should call it Catty McCatface.
Times Radio Breakfast, Monday morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with NetWealth. Wealth management as it should be. Find out more at netwealth.com.
Hello, Hugo Rifkind here on Times Radio, currently talking about hate with Matthew Williams. He is a professor of criminology who directs the Hate Lab at Cardiff University, and his book, The Science of Hate, was published on Thursday. Matthew, we were talking before about hate and hate crimes. You mentioned accelerants that lead to more hate crimes or that inspire yes. hate crimes. Tell us a bit about what you mean there. What are accelerants?
So there are basic kind of foundational elements of human beings that are pretty standard and constant between us all. But the things that vary most are the non-innate elements. These are the things that kind of happen to us throughout our lives. And so these are not equally distributed throughout society, which means that we tend to see more hate crimes in certain parts of the country and maybe in certain points in time. And I call these things the accelerants. So these are the elements that are of experience that can take a relatively benign prejudice, something that, you know, probably doesn't actually manifest in anything nefarious, no element of discrimination or certainly no element of sort of crime, but it can kind of take that very kind of core element and nurture it into something far more insidious. So these things, the accelerants include, for example, personal experience. So individuals who have experienced significant losses in their lives, for example, losing a job or a loved one, can actually identify alternative sources of that frustration in minority individuals. We see it consistently when we interview sort of racist offenders. We try to understand where their motivation comes from. We ask them, you know, they claim they're not racist, but when it actually comes out in sort of the psychoanalysis of the whole endeavor, we identify that their frustrations are linked to losses that they've experienced, and they use race as a container, if you like, in order to vent their frustration. So not everyone who suffers a loss does this, but all the hate offenders that we tend to speak to tend to cite this reason for their motivation. So personal, extreme personal loss that's not been dealt with in a healthy way can actually result in low impulse control in an average individual. It can result in crime, generally speaking, but it can also result in hate crimes. But ultimately, it doesn't answer the question alone. So there are other accelerants on top of that. Now, one of the other accelerants is trigger events. So the election of Donald Trump, the Brexit vote, the terror attacks in 2017, all of these were followed with subsequent massive increases in hate on the streets, both in the US and the UK.
And this, you would say, happened in a real identifiable way, because people claim this and people dispute it, but you're saying, no, that is actually there. The stats bear this out. These events did lead to rises in hate crime on the streets.
Yeah, well, this is a really good question because, you know, cause and effect is obviously something that's very difficult to prove in science. And when it comes to hate crime, there are three possible reasons why hate crimes go up. One is actual perpetration increasing, which is what I'm claiming. The other is an increase in reporting because people are more likely to report because they see the problem in the press and they become sort of enabled to report. And the police record it better. You know, the police improve their recording practices because they're notoriously not terribly good at recording this stuff historically. But we took this to task in a project that we got funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. And I looked at Brexit in particular and actually tried to control for those other two, increased reporting and increased recording. So we were able, for example, to get all the data on police training. We were also able to identify all the influences that might inspire someone to report more, like press coverage in newspapers, on radio and TV and so on. And while controlling for all those elements, we still identified an increase in perpetration around those events. So you cannot explain away the largest increases in hate over the last 5 years simply by saying people are reporting more. It's just not, it doesn't hold water in terms of the statistics or the science behind it.
Well, let's move maybe towards, as we move towards the end, let's take something a little bit more positive. You mentioned in the book the experience in Liverpool since Mo Salah started playing for Liverpool and the impact that appeared to have on hate crime. Mo Salah being an Egyptian, a Muslim, playing for Liverpool. Tell us a bit about that.
This was a remarkable story. So during my research for the book, this study was published by Stanford University and by an economist. So they're pretty good at their stats, as you can imagine. But the question was, does positive contact, and positive contact is a phenomenon known to reduce prejudice across various sectors in terms of workplaces, educational settings, and so on. So when you have contact with someone not like you, personal contact, and you work together, it has this amazing effect of eradicating negative stereotypes, and you become more tolerant and potentially even become friends with the person that you thought you possibly had a prejudice against or even hated. So Mo Salah represented this potential positive contact for Liverpool fans who had been pretty anti-Muslim, not all of them, pockets of them have been pretty anti-Muslim on social media, and anti-Muslim hate crimes were quite high in Liverpool at the time because this was around the time of the 2017 terror attacks. So we had like three attacks in a row, Manchester Arena, the rest in London, and it was a very tense time out there in the community, for Muslim communities, because hate crimes were on the rise. Remarkably, when Mo Salah joined in July 2017, the hate crime rate on the streets of Merseyside decreased by 16%. And interestingly, anti-Muslim tweets decreased by 50% from Muslim fans. Now, you might say, well, didn't that just happen everywhere? No, it didn't. In fact, hate crimes against Muslims were going up throughout the country at that point in time, and hate tweets were at an all-time high. So what we seem to have had there was this example of positive contact where a player who's doing incredibly well at his job, and he won loads of awards that year and the subsequent year, and obviously he was their star player, had this incredible effect of making some Liverpool fans who had been previously prejudiced against Islam support it, to the point at which actually they were singing songs, chants, in Anfield, praising Islam, which is absolutely astonishing. And it's just one of those nice stories that says, you know, this is a really intractable problem. We and especially in sport, it's incredibly intractable. But you've only got to look at examples like that to see a way out, I think. And I think
They look completely fascinating. I could very happily talk about this for another half hour, but I'm not allowed.
Thank
you very much indeed, Matthew Williams. That book, The Science of Hate, was published on Thursday. It is both fascinating and beautifully written, if I may say so. So I would heartily recommend it. Thank you very much, Matthew Williams. The Saturday Times is on sale now.